No, let's just go live. Let's not bother with that countdown clock in case it goes wrong. Sorry, everyone. We are late. It's my fault. I've had technical problems. I'm now on a Microsoft Edge browser. It's currently working. The Google Chrome browser decided not to work. Not really sure what happened there. Hope everyone's well. It's Midweek Gaming back again. Episode 45. And we're back on this fine Wednesday. I think Luke Steele is the guest today, and I don't think I know. I think he's on holiday. That's what I meant. So, you showed a nice video earlier. You were at the beach?
Yeah, I was. I went. I was actually, funnily enough, I wasn't intending to go to the beach. I was actually looking for ice cream. I was actually out hunting for an ice cream van, and we drove by the beach because we were like, well, there's ice cream there. And there wasn't ice cream, but there was the beach was very nice. So enjoyed that. And yes, I am on holiday. So I've got all of this week off.
Are you enjoying it?
Yeah, it's been great. Just having time off is always really refreshing, and it allows me to do stuff like this, which is even better. So.
Yeah, no, thanks for joining. There's obviously Luke Steele, if you don't know him, anyone. He's from the Green Pass Gaming Podcast every Sunday, 8 p.m. It's a very good show. And welcome, and thanks for coming on, and sorry about the tech issues.
No worries.
It's a first for this show, for actually, apart from my internet dying completely.
No, it's not.
Is it not the first time? I can't remember.
We've had numerous technical issues. Trust me, it's just like, no.
No. Well, it hasn't happened.
I can't remember the last time we
then.
Started on time. I can't remember the last time we started on time.
Oh, so. Yeah, no, exactly. It says 10 p.m. We never started 20 minutes late this week. So we'll crack on.
Go on.
Welcome, Removable Sanity. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Thanks for having me back on again. Much appreciated. You know I love to talk.
I do. Hopefully we've got enough time now. Yeah. So, okay. And welcome to VJ. How are you doing?
Hi, Stubbs. How are you doing? Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, now the old computer's working properly. It's all good.
I only just got here myself, so yeah, no worries. It's nice to see that we've got Luke on loan from his legal firm, Sue Grabbit and Run. And Removable Sanity here, who will obviously perform an exorcism for me. And it was nice to see Paul last week. Last week I thought he looked like Mel Gibson. This week Paul makes me think that Hollywood's casting for a new Western. So,
yeah, there you go.
But, yeah, other than that, I'm looking forward to the show.
Good to hear. And that's it. Yeah. And Cerebral Paul.
You didn't really say
welcome to Cerebral Paul. Cerebral Paul, how are you doing? Well, thanks for coming
screw
on.
You, I'm leaving. Bye.
Thanks for all the panel joining us and Paul.
Yeah. Now he's got his brand deal. He's off now.
Now he's with Hollywood. Yeah. Obviously, he wanted to give him a second look. He said, I'm not into it.
Good to be here. I'm looking forward to a great show.
But yeah, hopefully it goes smooth now. Welcome, Masuku. Fun speculation. Back from the Dead has seen as well. Thanks for stopping in, people. So I moan on Twitter about rumours. I know I do. But this one I've seen. I don't quite know why this exists, but we'll have a talk about it. Basically, a new Seagate expansion card has surfaced for the Xbox Series X and S. With a smaller capacity, only 500 gigabyte, where the standard is 1 terabyte. It leaked from French website Xbox Squad reports that a new source gave them information on the new 500 gig version of the expansion card. And it's reported to will cost about between being sold to suppliers for €125 before tax, so it'd be about 150 to 169 euros. I mean, in my opinion, I don't really see why you need a memory card that low. If the 1 gigabyte SSD, you know, I think you'd want the 2 or 3 or 4 next. But It's just me.
The only reason I'd want one that low is because that would hold my Call of Duty. That's it.
That there you go. They could call it the Call of Duty stick.
Or the price was significantly lower.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, it was actually half the price of the one terabyte. Yeah. Then maybe you could say, well, actually, it's hitting those with a limited budget, a limited pocket, and it does provide them something. You know, maybe with the X Cloud being introduced and a cheaper, external add-on hard drive space, it might open itself up to a bigger audience. But from the price you've just quoted, it's literally what, I don't know, 20-30 euros or something less. It's really less than a one terabyte version.
You might have to just save the extra 30-40 quid and get the bigger one. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's like, if it was like 70 or 80, I could understand it. Yeah, it's half the price, it's half the space. Actually, for people who are struggling, that could make some sense for people. And ironically, I know you joke about it, Paul, but stuff like, you're right, as you said, it holds a particular game or a particular couple of games you don't want to keep messing around with backwards and forwards that you always play. You can literally keep that stored somewhere, plop it in at the back, bam.
Yeah. And that, to me, that's the only thing it's good for. Other than that, I'm not sure what the market draw is. You know?
VJ would be able to tell you that.
I'm just surprised we've forgotten our manners and didn't ask our guests to go first. Well, sorry about our rude podcast, just, Luke. You know,
sorry about that, Luke.
It's chaos. It's chaos.
It's all gone wrong.
I think my opinion is, the price is a little bit strange. Well, on the one hand, it's a little bit strange. On the other, I think perhaps it's somewhat deliberate. There's, you know, a psychology of pricing that goes on a lot of the times where, you know, you can price something that's just a little bit lower, but clearly, you know, deficient compared to the thing you actually want people to buy. So it might be somewhat tactical in that, you know, you putting them right next to each other on the shelf, people will just have the same reaction that we will, right? Which is that, well, why would I buy the 500 gig when I can get the one terabyte, and they'll plump up the extra cash for it. And then, yeah, I think maybe, you know, it's just a slightly cheaper option on the other hand for other people. Personally, I'm not really someone who buys expendable storage. Like I don't have anything like that for my Series X or PS5. Just because I never install or never want to install, you know, tons and tons of games. I'm quite happy just having kind of six or seven on at one time. But yeah, it's interesting. I don't know quite the reasons why they're coming out with a 500 gig version that is seemingly priced so close to the one terabyte, because you would think the natural thing to do would be to price it, you know, a way off, so it is actually a cheaper alternative. But, you know, who knows?
No, you've got good thoughts there. I mean, you are right. It could be a tactic to make people think, I'll just buy the one terabyte. But then again, it's a cheaper option, not if people can't afford the one terabyte, but
yeah.
My opinion, save your pennies and buy the bigger one.
Yeah, and I think that's probably what Microsoft are hoping that people do as well, which is to, you know, save your pennies and Seagate in this case. But I think I think unfortunately at the moment because the expendable solution is, you know, proprietary in many respects, the difficulty is that prices really aren't going to go anywhere until more people like Seagate come into the market and actually start producing their own versions. Seems at the minute that Seagate kind of have a bit of a monopoly on that, or really the only ones that want to come into it. So hopefully we start seeing other hardware manufacturers come in and actually, you know, giving people alternatives and actually pushing the prices down of these things.
Hopefully. I mean, I think that might come at the point when more and more people buy them. I don't know how many people have actually bought these expansion devices. I don't know whether they sell in the thousands. I don't know.
Yeah.
Hopefully, over time, the price comes down. on it, but you got very good opinions on it. You got any opinions, VJ, to add?
Well, I was going to say, I think Removable made, it might have been Paul, made a good point that if the, I don't know the current pricing, so I'm just guessing here, because I don't know the pricing in England, but if the price equates to being half the price of the 1 terabyte card, then I'm all for an additional option. For some, it's about, from a consumer point of view, we're all different, right? So it's all, some of us are quite cautious, right? And want to pay for incremental storage to test and see if we'll actually use it, you know, use the extra space. I mean, I'm just talking from my own usage. I manage fine with the 1 terabyte of internal storage. So although I do seem to delete and download games at least once or twice a week, and I think that's because I don't have any sort of qualms or anxiety having to do so, but I think it's partly because I play single player games, so it's easier for me to plan ahead in terms of what I've finished and delete and then install another game. And I normally have about 70 to 100 gig still always free. But I will say that sometimes when I was on a community game night, so I'd find that I'd need like several titles on hand, right? Unless I'm, you know, especially when I'm sort of jumping in and out of different multiplayer games at a whim, you know, whether it's Sea of Thieves, Forza, Halo, Titanfall, they're all really quite big games, right? In terms of storage. But so that's my experience, because I don't play as many multiplayer games. I'm on single player games. I can plan better, so I don't need as much storage. But then if you like have asked this question, if Mr. Tushu was here tonight, he'd definitely opt and prefer, you know, for as much fast and optimum storage and hoping for it to be economically priced. And he'd be arguing the point, why isn't there a 2 terabyte option? And correct me if I'm wrong. And in terms of the pricing, and I think like what you and Luke were saying, Stubbs, is that if the 500 gigabyte memory card is perhaps, you know, a 10 to 15 pound premium, i.e., you know, 500 gigabyte cards will cost you, what does that work out to? 220 or 230 long term, right? If the 1 terabyte card, I think, is about 200 quid in England. And that's if you're a cautious person and you want to choose to buy your storage in sort of bite-sized incremental purchases, right? So versus splashing out, what, 200 quid is it in England for straight off the bat?
I think it's 190, I thought it was 220. I might be. It's probably,
no, they dropped it. Amazon's doing it down about 190.
These might be Jersey prices. Okay. Everything's always cheaper over there. But Luke will be able to chime in on that. That was just a joke. Sorry. What I'm thinking about. Okay. So why would I be okay with just 10 to 15 quid increase in the cost of memory card? You know, because all you're really doing is paying for the shell, right, for the card, for the memory itself, and then subsequent packaging and shipping, right? Because obviously for someone like Seagate, I'm assuming that the form factor is going to be the same for the 500 and the and the 100 gigabyte 1 terabyte and the 500 gig, because it's got a slot in the back of the Xbox. I haven't done it myself, so correct me if I'm wrong. So I could live with 1 terabyte being, you know, that bit more value for money, right, as an incentive for shelling out 200 quid or $250 or whatever it is over here, right, straight off the bat. So but any more than a 10 to 15 pound premium over a period of time per each card, I would see as a bit of a put off. But I can understand that a percentage of consumers feeling a little disgruntled, right, if that 500 gigabyte card, as you guys were saying in the beginning, is, I think Luke was saying, well, look, you know, what's the point, right? If it's only going to be 30 or 40 quid cheaper, you might as well just go and invest in a terabyte storage. I guess it's the same sort of argument with the price disparity between the Series S and the X. It's not significant enough for me, right, to buy an S. I'd look to buy an X. But in this modern day and age, what you've got to look at is that consumers come in all shapes, sizes and colours, right? A bit like Bertie Bassett's licorice all sorts. God, it's been so long. I can't get that stuff over here in America. I'll think about them all. And fruit pastels. Yeah. Anyway, so if everything else pretty much comes in all shapes and sizes and there's all different sort of purchasing habits out there, right, given the size of the global population that are playing video games. So why not memory cards, right? But for me, it's when I look at from the manufacturing point of view, right, I think that these guys, you know, whether it's Seagate or any company producing anything, are always going to have a look and say, look, you know what, $200 cards or £200 cards are kind of selling, but they're not. So what's the sort of a sweet spot of a price where when someone's buying an Xbox, you can see right now that the 1 terabyte storage at $200 or $250 at half the price of the console isn't isn't an immediate, how can I put it, like a checkout accompanying accessory, right? So they may be thinking, well, look, or maybe they've done their research and thinking, well, look, if it's at $100 or $150, if it, I mean, I'm just, it's just guessing here, right? Because we're all assuming it may or may not be sort of reasonably priced, right? But if they can get it to that point, and they sell, I'm sure they're going to be making more profit on the 500 gigabyte card, right? Which is obviously going to contribute a higher margin to their bottom line, which is the name of the game for these guys. And look, let's be honest, if they do come out a bit more expensive and they do like build a load of these 500 gigabyte cards and they don't sell, you can be guaranteed they're going to tighten up the supply of 1TB cards until they sell out of the 500 gig cards, or they can quite easily ship excess stock of 500 gigabyte cards to territories where consumers, like you were saying, Removable, don't have the money to go and spend, don't see the common sense in spending like half as much money as the console on a storage card, right? And or where they, you know, they're happy to spend 100 or whatever, right? Or maybe just playing single player games like me that don't need that much storage. And as I say, they can quite easily, you know, if there's like an overstock in France, they can quite easily ship it to America, right? Repackage it and just put it into territories where it is selling well, right? Until they sell out and then just switch back to 1TB cards. But anyway, those are my thoughts on it. That's the sort of dodgy dealings that I would do with Delbo and Rodney.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. I do. My fun speculation was saying in chat that apparently there was a 1 year Seagate deal is almost up. So I think for the first year they had an exclusive deal on doing the card. So potentially could open up now to other companies trying to make them.
See, I would ask a question.
Western Digital would be ideal.
Removable, you might be able to answer this or Paul, but if the tech for that memory card is proprietary or there is a chip in there that Microsoft is supplying, that if it is opened up, they're all going to have a license from Microsoft to make those cards to be able to insert into the Xbox Series X, right? Or I don't know if the S-Tech's an expanded cartridge. So if they do open it up, then if there's more manufacturers making it, may be more competitive, but it really depends on what that licensing fee is from Xbox, right? That determines ultimately, you know, whether there's a, you know, maximum, I reckon, would be about $5 to $10, maybe $15 difference, right, between certain manufacturers. But I guess they're all out to make as much money as they possibly can.
I don't think it's a, and I could be wrong here, I don't think it's a hardware aspect, because I think the basic fundamental hardware, the specs have been given to more than just one producer. I think it's a software element. So I suspect it'll be, they'll produce the packaging, as you say, and then it'll be, you know, it'll be have to be download this particular software item, which would then make it run smoothly into the Xbox itself, because I think I remember seeing on YouTube a guy and again it was going around on Twitter where they had an adapter and they were plugging in standard SSD cards, where some it would register and actually identify that the fact the card was there but wouldn't work, and some it wouldn't even register. And I think his conclusion was that it was a software implementation. So the cards themselves and the hardware can be moved and swapped around, which makes sense, which means it could be, you know, utilized across a variety of different producers. But the almost like the key to that, the key to get in and use it to its optimum, would be a software element.
Yeah, that would be probably Microsoft's stance would be, you have to have this because it's a security feature. We can't just have people plugging in any card into our machines. I'm guessing.
And for that, pay a royalty, right?
Yeah.
Oh, without a doubt, yeah.
But I would imagine that once they all can make their own versions, the cards will come down because there'll be competition in the market and they'll all compete. And that's better for the consumer, that is, in the end.
Yeah, I think I think at this stage there is, well, there's also a little bit of a, I think if you've been keeping an eye on SSDs, there's a little bit of a bite back to some of the producers, because they've been spotting that SSDs are not exactly doing what they've been touted. They're using, in some cases, cheaper materials. So, for instance, I could buy like a 2 terabyte SSD here in England, and exactly the same product VJ could buy but he might find that he has a superb, almost like a superseded hardware element. And they've been spotting it. I think Linus Tech or something. He was going through and they tested the same product, five different areas. And they realized that it was actually a slightly inferior hardware in some cases. And it was like a big, oh, hang on a minute, what the hell's going on here sort of situation. So I think there's a little bit of that going on as well in some of the SSD producers. So, I mean, this would also mean that if Microsoft has this software element, it could kind of force them to a particular spec or particular standard to ensure that, you know, the SSDs are always at that grade which Microsoft would want it to be.
Exactly, you're right. It's like it's interesting. It's just a situation, and we've got to keep an eye on it. Is see how it progresses. Hopefully, you'll soon be able to get a card for 80 quid. You never know. 500 gig. You never know. No, I'd buy a card for 500 gig for 80 quid. I don't know how far we are off that. We might be quite far off that price, but who knows? Are you back yet, Paul? No, he did say.
I'd buy as many cards as I possibly could if I was using either Paul or Luke's credit card.
That is welcome, Muppet. Welcome, Dragon Wolf. One awaits Dragon. UK Dazarus. Who else we got? This came in. Go Force came in. Calyrax. One awaits Dragon's TV. Thanks for stopping in. Yeah, no, that's been a good topic. Is Paul still still the way? Yeah, I think he is. I have to skip to the next topic we have because now it's not a big topic. I just wondered that basically the creator of the ZX8 and ZX81 and the ZX Spectrum has died at the age of 81. Sir Clive Sinclair, the British entrepreneur and inventor, has died at age 81. Did any of you guys play the Spectrum or remember it? Because I don't remember it. I remember playing once at my uncle's house, and I think that was it. I just thought I'd bring it up because it's part of British history. It is.
Yeah. It was one of my very first PCs. There was a few systems. I think there's a 32K system, a 48K system, and I was lucky enough to get the 128K with inbuilt cassette deck. It was a fantastic machine at the time. I mean, you know, it shows how bad it is. You could spend 6 hours typing in code, and it would draw half a circle. And at that time, wow. It was like, you'd be like, I'm a coding god, you know, back in those days. You'd be like, yeah, I'm amazing. You know, it was a fantastic machine at the time. He was quite a unique entrepreneur, as a lot of our British seem to be. He seems to be, you know, he had a unique set of ways of doing things. He liked to be a little bit out there. But yeah, no, it was a machine that kind of really took off, and its only rivals, and again, VJ, you might be helping me on this one, was that I think his rivals early on was Amstrad and Commodore. They were the key rivals before I think Atari kind of kicked in, and then obviously Windows at the time, sort of thing. But yeah, if you wanted to start off, I'd say that was the earliest PC. It wasn't the earliest PC, was it? BJ, was it the earliest one?
I'm not sure. I was going to say we're being rude again, but I was just going to say I wasn't sure if our guest is Luke's old enough to have this conversation or not.
I assumed he was young.
Yeah, my knowledge of this extends to I would say exactly what you're describing at the moment, and that's about it. Yeah, I am aware of the Spectrum in particular, but yeah. way before my time. Not to toot my young horn, but way before my
these
time.
These 20-year-olds, I don't know.
36.
I don't know how old I was, but I think I can't remember from my first experience of it was obviously Pong and something similar on an Intellivision or something similar to that. And then not soon after that, I used to play on my friend's on his first Spectrum with the rubber keys. And then not very long after that, I got my own ZX Spectrum Plus, not the 128K. And I used to play I mentioned this on the show before, Night Law, Horace Goes Skiing, The Hobbit. Mm-hmm. Obviously all copy games, nothing original.
Ghostbusters.
And then obviously, you know, sort of going to school in those days, you'd only have to walk by a chippy and, you know, you just, arcade cabinets were everywhere, right? With video games in them. And I very quickly switched to arcade cabinets. And then from there, the Sega Master System was launched by, I think it was Virgin Mastertronic in the 80s. I switched to that. And then I remember, you know, obviously, I kind of had the Spectrum. It was somewhere. Then I obviously saw, I think it was on BBC, I think, the Sinclair C5 appeared on the 9 o'clock news with Mrs. Sinclair. And then I'm really sorry to digress, but I remember about that time as well when I was looking at the Sinclair C5 and I was wondering if they were going to – there'd be a lot of playground arguments over the ZX Spectrum 128 and the – was it the Amiga and the ST?
Mm-hmm.
The three at the time before the consoles came in. And then there was a British company. I forgot – was it – I know the system. It was called the Connex Multisystem, and it had a power chair. And it was gonna, you know, and it had a monitor in the, and it had a monitor as well within the chair, and you know, it'll be a hydraulic and everything. And it was, I remember first seeing it. I think I first saw it on the front cover of Ace magazine. And Ace magazine, if you don't know what Ace magazine is, it was sort of the Edge magazine equivalent at that time, right? I remember that they were saying that, the Connex Multisystem is going to have its first public appearance over at Earl's Court in London. I think it was called the ECTS back then, and ECTS was European Computer Trade Show. I know you know Removable, but I'm just sort of just spelling it out for the youngsters. Yeah.
I'm feeling really young at the minute. It's weird.
It's brilliant, isn't it? It's fantastic, yeah.
Your hair would tell a
back
different
story. Back in our day, your hair wearing phones on the story, wall.
I've got no hair. So,
I was going to say, that tells a different story entirely. But so the Connex Multisystem, the first game I saw running on there was the Last Ninja from System 3. Yep. And back then I thought, oh my goodness, I can't wait this to get back home. And obviously the Connex Multisystem never saw the light of day. I think it was made by a Welsh company of all companies. And then I was trying to get around this massive crowd around the chair because I was quite short back then. I'm taller now, obviously, I'm 6 foot now. And I managed to sort of just get a sneak peek. And I can't quite remember what the game was that was running on the chair and the monitor. I think it might have been Chase HQ from Taito. That was another game I played on the Spectrum quite a lot as well. So anyway, those are my memories from back then. And you can just flush them down the toilet if you like.
No, it was a little bit of a. It's hard to describe. It was for those back in the day. You could go to a newspaper stand, and games were placed on a cassette. And now, obviously, for the very young, you'll never know what a cassette really is. But a cassette was
sellotape.
Sellotapes. Yeah, yeah.
You say, why sellotape? And these would ripping my cover.
Yeah. And this cassette itself would normally have about 6 to 7 games on it, and this would be strapped to a magazine, and you'd buy it for the equivalent. I think if I remember, it's about £1.25, yep. Which is now probably what. $2, barely $2 now, sort of thing. And every, I think it would be every, almost every other week, you could get a brand new game, plop it into this little cassette deck, press button, and then wait for about half hour with the most horrendous noises coming out of it. Before you then popped up a little game, would play, and you'd be able to play it. It was.
I'd have to disagree with you. I thought those sounds were quite therapeutic.
Yeah, it depends on which one it was. Ghostbusters was really good. When you plugged in the Ghostbusters cassette tape, that was actually quite unique. I quite enjoyed that. But there were some like Werewolf in London, and it was like, Jesus, it was like you're calling Satan, you know, from a cassette tape. It was horrendous. But you'd just listen to it because it'd be like, okay, fine. But it was, I had fond memories of, I must admit I have, and I still have got my ZX Spectrum 128k, and it does bring back a lot of memories. And actually, there is now, and I think Paul, you might be able to help us out. There is actually kind of a resurgence between old retro games, systems being actually redone and updated. And if I remember correctly, I think there was a Kickstarter for the Spectrum that actually it was redone, re-implemented, and actually then had, I think it was Bluetooth and Pi and internet added to it. There's almost like a mini resurgence of these systems coming through.
Do you remember? I mean, I was playing. There's a on Game Pass. There's the Rare package, and they've got like stuff like Sabrewulf and Nightlaw. And I was trying to play Nightlaw with Xbox controller, and I was thinking, oh my god, I need my quick shot joystick. I can't bloody play this game with a controller. Do you remember the quick shot joysticks? Didn't last very long, but they were really, really good.
Yeah, the suckers at the bottom where you'd have to slam it into your desk to suck onto something.
Yeah,
and within a space of about three or four, you know, holding this joystick, it would go and come off in your hand again. And you'd be like, then you slam it back into your desk and then try and stick it there harder. I think people would duct tape it.
Are you trying to outdo Stubbs's happy ending innuendos from last week? That's all I want to know.
Oh, that was a crazy show last week. That was, yeah.
Yeah, Muppet, see, for you youngsters.
Are you on about Rare Replay, Muppet said? What you're on about?
Rare Replay, yeah, that's it, yeah.
Yeah. See, this is the thing, you youngsters would have done that.
Some of those games is what I grew up on, so yeah, long time.
Yeah. Limited saves there, I tell you. Or no saves in most cases.
No saves, no. No saves.
Yeah. Saves, what would that? No chance. Yeah, it must admit, it did bring and I was quite surprised at how many people, and especially actually what I was surprised about was developers today who are developing games were paying tribute to him. They were saying, he inspired me to go down this path.
Cool.
And it was because you kind of don't realize someone's legacy until you know you get till you lose them, and then the wave of people you know come across and you know start spreading their memories of the system itself. And watching it unfold on Twitter, well, it must admit it did bring a little tear to my eye seeing that so many people were inspired.
I was going to say, Stubbs, there's a message from Dragon Wolf just dropped in the community chat for you.
Quackshot joysticks is why. I'm not saying the rest of that.
I'm pretty sure that's not why your grip is so strong on that side.
Oh, no. have you got any fond memories, Paul, of Sinclair Systems?
Yeah, you can see the first computer I actually owned was a Sinclair. I posted a link in the chat.
Oh, yeah, see it now. I don't want to risk my computer. I'm going wrong forever. In the minute.
But, yeah, so it wasn't the first computer I used by a long shot, but it was the first computer I owned myself, was a Timex Sinclair, which was a deal with Timex and the Sinclair company.
That would be worth something now.
Yeah. I even had the expanded memory that brought it up to like 32K or whatever it was.
Mm.
And that cost $100 by itself. So there you go.
Those days
was fun. So yeah, it is interesting to know that the reason a lot of people say that's kind of because a lot of us got our start on my age and a little bit got our start on those kind of machines. That's how we learned to program. That's how we learned, you know, some of the basic stuff that grew into what we do now. So,
well, that was it. As I said earlier, it's like, you know, you spend almost like 5 to 6 hours typing out code and it would draw half a circle and you think, I am a coding god, you know.
Either that or you're typing it in for all that time and your dad would come in and go, time to go to bed, turn that off.
Oh, yep. Crap.
Oh, no! I think I could be wrong. I think in the UK, obviously, they had BBC computers and obviously Sinclairs, and kids used to program.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically phased out. I mean, I think they've started to try to reintroduce programming into education again, but they haven't got a lot of that skill set's gone. Because like, it would be interesting if Xbox would launch a pilot program where there's a special app where you could play around with making games just for anyone.
There is actually, well, in the UK, they are actually doing, it's crazy now. They are actually doing coding apps and coding elements for children. My cousin's got it, and he's literally, I don't know, he's about six. And this, there he is. He's dropping, drag and dropping these little elements together, and making and coding up and making something move around. I'm like, Jesus, even I can't actually physically understand that.
It's what the problem is. They've lost a skill set, and a lot of the jobs that is needed in the UK, people are obviously coming to live in the UK from elsewhere around the world, and they thought, well, let's try and get some of the next generation into coding, so that way, you know, it's easy.
Yeah,
for them, you
know? Around the 80s, there was a little bit of a little renaissance in terms of coding. It was kind of pushed quite heavily. It was seen as the future of tomorrow, as they said. There's a program called Future of Tomorrow, and it would be like, you know, coding would be part and parcel of your day-to-day life. Every single person, mother, child, and auntie would be coding in some format, you know, these ridiculous sort of little aspects that would like never really see the light of day. But it was, you know, we started off, you know, learning how to do databases, you know, how to make these little early little simplistic databases. And you're right, it kind of got phased out because I think mostly of the expense. Computers started getting, and it was at the time where, yes, it was about £100 back then, but they had some schools were given quite a bit of funds to provide these tools for the students. But as computers started getting more and more expensive and more diverse in terms of software and hardware, the people who was in charge of these funds couldn't really keep up with the technology that was speeding ahead, and also couldn't rationalize spending that amount of money. And so that's why it kind of got phased out of schools, at least here anyway.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I would say here, because in the 90s, I was actually working at schools, and they got away from the actual programming side and just got into the how to use a computer side. So we had a lot of computer users, but nobody who actually understood how it works from the inside.
Oh, so it happened in America as well. It's a shame, really. It is. Hopefully it's phased back in.
Some schools are bringing in things like Python, which is a programming language, which... Guess what it has? It's some little hints of inside the programming language, Monty Python, which makes it fun, you know. So, but yeah, there are some hints of it, but it's almost like you have to go out of your way to find a programming course, and you're probably not going to run into it till you go to college, which is really sad, because a lot of us started when we were younger, much younger, you know.
Mm. Yep.
Because now those resources are there, but they're not in your face. You know, when I was, you know, you had the same basic computer. You turned it on. You didn't have something you could click on and go. You had, okay, what do I need to type to get it to do this thing?
Yeah. Yeah, it was a unique time.
And most of that is gone, you know. Yeah.
It is. So it looks, well... Looks like they are trying in some aspect to get that back. It is, but kids want to be YouTubers and influencers and stuff like that these days and dream of it. But one in a million will actually do it. They will. Yep. That's the reality of it. But anyway,
I was going to say real quick, even a lot of the video game building for parts of it, especially, is drag this, put this thing here on the screen and put it over here, and then we're going to make it do this. There's not enough. There is some coding involved, but it's not all like it used to be, you know.
No, it's not. It's not a DOS system. Well, you know, it's very much a drag and drop system where, as you were saying, Paul, ironically, strangely enough, if you can find someone who has a very good DOS experience, they can earn a fortune. Whilst it is a kind of a lost talent, it's one that I don't think will go away. Well, and if you want to get in to make some big money...
It's not just DOS, it's things like languages I was introduced to, COBOL, Fortran. A lot of your banks and older systems still use some of those systems, but they're running out of people who know how to program in it because we're all dying off. You know, it's like,
Yeah, if you want to make, if you want to go down, if you're young enough now and you want to try and make a bit of money, these are systems that are still, these are systems that are still being used today. It's being built on, in fact. You've got to remember, these systems never really haven't disappeared. They've just been, they've been had stuff put on top of them. And so the basic fundamentals.
They're being bridged because they can't afford to take them offline for any extended period of time.
That's it. They're so integrated now that if you break something, it kind of, it's like a house of cards, except for it's a pyramid, upside down pyramid. Is if you break something at the bottom, everything above is going to go, is going to fall. So yeah, it's a strange one that I'm surprised that not many people are realizing that you can earn a lot of money. But I suppose, as you said, it's trying to find someone who can teach you now. And we are running out of time, you know.
Yep. The whole system is a house of cards, like I said, and it's just waiting to come crumbling down at some point, you know.
Stubbs got quiet.
Yes, I know. Here we go. No, no, I thought that was an interesting topic. That was. So now, this is a topic. I'm going to go over a different one. It was on the list, obviously. This is what I've been seeing a lot. I mean, I knew, and this will probably spark a lot of your opinions on this one, especially removable. And I think Luke,
all of you, really.
No, it's not actually. Basically, should games ever be marked in reviews with 10 out of 10s? Because you see them everywhere, don't you? 10 out of 10, 10 out of 10 on all these cool graphics, the latest game. Should a game ever actually receive 10 out of 10? Luke Steele, I'm going to you first. I've been told off a few times by VJ so far. I'll go to our guest, Luke.
It's all right. I think the way I've always looked at reviews, and look, you know, people can take, you can take your own stock in reviews as high or as little as you want, right? It's ultimately a review is just an opinion. That's all it is. You may or may not agree with it when you actually engage with the products on your own terms. So, but the way I've always looked at reviews are, especially 10 out of 10s are, is not that, you know, 10 out of 10 is perfection. 10 out of 10 usually, it's for me, just means the game is outstanding, because there's no game that's perfection. You know, I can list off any game that I, you know, think is, you know, one of the best games I've ever played, and I can find fault, something wrong with it. I can find, you know, sometimes many things wrong with them, right? So I don't think there's any issue reviewing a game and giving it a 10 if you genuinely believe that, you know, well, the experience I had with it is commensurate to the score I'm giving it. I think the difficulty now maybe is that many websites, you know, many establishments don't use a full scale, and so, you know, for those, you know, when you're getting into that, effectively, if you're getting anything lower than, you know, a six, seven. Yeah, or a seven sometimes, right, that's seen as a bad score. Because the scale is lopsided. Some Edge in the UK, for example, are a really good example of a you know, reviewing system where they use a full scale. So they do sometimes give games really low scores, and if you get a 10 from Edge, you know, it's incredibly, you know, it's actually quite a, I don't want to say prestigious, but it's actually quite an achievement to do that, because they really do reserve that for, you know, what they consider to be the top of top games. But it's more difficult now, you know, as I said, when the full scale of review isn't really used in many places, particularly amongst the bigger gaming websites. I don't think there's ever any difficulty in giving something a 10, and I don't take umbrage with it. Obviously, I think the more important thing is that if you're engaging with reviews, that you should probably look to ones that you trust, and not necessarily to everyone that's out there, because, you know, it's just an opinion. And it's one of the reasons why I get really frustrated with people who, you know, take so much stock in reviews, take, you know, they get so angry at reviews, right, when they really love a game or really hate a game and think that it should get X, Y, or Z. Because I don't understand why I get so angry at someone just giving an opinion on a game. It's just total nonsense. It's just total nonsense. But that's slightly digressing.
No, you are right. It's just it is just an opinion, and I see it a lot. I just wanted to get everyone's opinion. That's fair enough. Yeah. If that's your opinion on it, that's it's all good. Just wanted to gauge the opinion of the panel. What's your thoughts, Cerebro? I can see you. I see you want to talk.
How can you tell? Hey, no, I honestly don't. If I were to use a scale of 1 to 10, I would never ever give a game, movie, book, or anything a 10, because nothing is ever perfect. You know, like I said, there's always room for improvement. As far as the only time I might get angry at a reviewer for something they said, sometimes it could be good or bad, it doesn't matter, is if I know from playing the game or experiencing the same experience that they're talking out of their ass, that, you know, that they don't know what they're actually talking about. Especially if it's
yeah, some people haven't completed the entire game and they say something about it.
Yeah, and you want to go, no, that's not the way it is. Were you not paying attention? You know, so there is that aspect to it. But to generally just not like to get mad at somebody because they don't like something I like in general, no, that's stupid, you know. But I would never, like I said, as much as I like Red Dead Redemption 2, I've run into some problems with it, so I wouldn't give it a 10. I tend to top out at about 8.5, seriously, you know, because I can always find little things, and it's not being nitpicky, it's being honest, you know. Yeah. Now, is it easy for me to give a game a 1? Possibly, because there are some really shit games out there. That I can't find anything positive to say about this game. You know, when you finish a game and you go, the best thing I saw was the ending credits because I know it was over. You know,
wow, like, that's bad. You know, that's bad.
Yeah, but I've run into games like
that's a 2. If you get unless to the end, surely that's a 0, isn't it?
Yeah, unless there's a spelling error in the credits, then it drops it down some more. You know.
Mm.
But that's where I stand on that, really. I mean, it's, you know, it's nothing deep about it. It's just, even when I do my goofy little movie reviews, I don't use number of value systems. You know, I don't believe in them because they're subjective. You know, we know all about the site that, you know, nothing gets, you know, hardly Xbox gets over 76. Does that mean it's a bad game? No. It just means that a bunch of reviewers...
Yeah, the problem I have is I feel sorry for publishers and developers because for some reason, I'll say it, the website you didn't want to mention Metacritic, and a lot of the big publishing arms, they use the game you just made and put your heart and soul into, they use your last Metascore, I believe. I can't, no developers ever confirm this, but it's been a lot of talk about this in various podcasts and all sorts over the past few years on it. And it's believed that you get your next budget for your next game, not based off sales, which surprised me, or engagement. It was based off what bloody Metascore you got. And that shocked me. I couldn't believe
that. That was a historical context. That's more of a historical thing.
Right. Yeah.
I would say that was probably prevalent in around the 2010s, 2015s. In the last,
I think it still
four
goes
five
on,
years,
though.
There is some, but I think a lot of publishers maybe, now have realized.
We've talked about this before. I don't think they put near as much weight on it as they used to.
Yeah,
because they know about review bombing. They know about review bombing. They know about that people
remember. It was a historically. It was to do with. It was normally picked. It was normally placed onto a website or placed onto an element, or collated through a magazine. It was normally right. That's it. Picks it up. It was a much more static. You know, review bombing was less. I would say it wasn't an issue, but it was less of an issue or less of a prevalence. Around those periods.
I think it also started to switch when certain magazines like IGN and stuff like that got caught doing, you know, pay to play.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. They were getting good reviews for shit games because the company was paying them a shitload of money to run ads for the game, and you don't want to shit on the guy who's advertising, who's paying for advertisement, so you give the game a good review, you know. And they got caught doing that. A few of the magazines got caught doing that. And that's why to this day I don't look at those magazines, especially for game reviews.
It's gone quiet again.
Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah, but no, you are right, you know. I thought it still happened now, but it's probably phased out more, it has. Because it's probably an old way of doing things. I know Xbox don't do that to their games, obviously. It's probably a more older thing that's probably being phased out now. Well, I'd like to hope it's being phased out anyway.
I would think with social media the way it is, they have a better gauge of what the actual player base thinks than they used to, because we're more out there for them, you know.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I know Removable have some thoughts on this subject, as he reviews
games. I was going to be the last person. I was going to hold off.
Okay, VJ, have you got any thoughts on this one?
Just before I give my thoughts, because I'm not going to change them, but I did like what Shizno Elite had to say in the chat, that he doesn't like putting a number on a game, much rather pros and cons. And sometimes, not so much now, because I kind of know what I'm going to play, and it's either in Game Pass or I'm going to buy it full price. And I've, you know, done my research on the game, and, you know, I know that I'm going to play it and I'm probably going to enjoy it, just because we just live in such times of abundance. But sometimes if there's a franchise, and I think it was Persona 5, and I kind of watched a video on it, a review, but I couldn't quite grasp what sort of game it was and what the flow of the game was, et cetera, et cetera. So I did actually try to look for pros and cons, and that helped me to understand the game a lot better. So I just wanted to say that there is a Shizno Elite in the chat does raise a really good point. But I can understand a game may not resonate or sort of, and these are my thoughts, or in particular, or reverberate with you or with anyone or with myself to a degree, you know, when you play it, and no game turns out, you know, well, perhaps some do, kind of turn out exactly the way you expect them to. And you see a lot of people sort of marking games down because of it. And I've seen some, seen some zero reviews, because you know, I know the topic was coming up, and I got to say that no game deserves a zero, right? It just shows you you're not in control of your emotions or your thoughts or your energies, or you have any control over your physiology, right? If you're in terms of lashing out at somebody, or, you know, it's a good thing they can't grab hold of you and lynch you these days. They just tweet at you, which is probably a lot safer. They're just you just see people's faculties, you know, they're just unaware that they have any. And you're obviously going to, you know, you're just going to come across some really, you know, poor opinions out there. But when I look at a game, you know, whether I'm playing it or not, right, and you're kind of asking the question, does any game deserve a 10? And you can look at it in so many different ways. I think Luke's mentioned it, you've mentioned it, I think Removal said a couple of things, and even Paul said different ways. And it's not a case of do we review it this way or that way, do we give it a 10 or not. I just think that just from listening to you guys and reading the chat, everybody is looking at it from a different point of view, or reflecting on gaming in a different way, which is okay, which is absolutely fine, right? And in for me, because this question was kind of asked before a long, long time ago, but in a different way, not as direct. But for me, everyone has a different perception of a value of a game and how much joy it brings you in terms of how you rate it. And for me, it is sometimes about, you know, the price of a game. And I think that's what the topic was, is that, you know, should games cost 60? Should games cost 70? And I said, look, many games that cost 60, you know, aren't worth 60. There should be a 30 or 40. And many games that are 30 or 40, I'd happily pay $60, $70 or $80 for them, right? Because remember, I'm from the 70s, 80s and 90s, right, when console gaming was truly expensive back then compared to what it is now. And also, you know, what I would look at is not just the quality of the game, is it's in terms of its engagement, right, and what it meant for me during that time frame. So, and I'll say this because I have sort of many games I replay or I wish to replay. I mean, it's completely subjective at the end of the day, and that's okay, right, whether you choose or choose not to. For me, it's always been down to, regardless of the pricing, regardless of how long the game is, etc., it's about how that particular game, what the build-up was to it when I played it, how did it fundamentally engage my imagination, and for what period of time, and how much joy did it give me? And if you ask me, oh, you know, today, right, recent games that I've played in the last couple of years, you know, whether they were like Hollow Knight or God of War or, you know, or Night Law, the specific moment in time when I played them, they were 10 out of 10. And Hollow Knight and God of War, for me, are still 10 out of 10 games. But if now we were talking about Night Law, and I try to play it on the rare replay, does it still hold that 10 out of 10 game that I played night and day after school and at weekends, you know, not doing my homework and all that sort of stuff? Back then it was, but not now. So, you know, and I guess in the future, if I go back to specific games, depending on where technology goes, I guess it's a question of, you know, those games that gave you so much joy at that specific moment of time, and you out of euphoria or whatever, or out of emotion, you gave it 10 out of 10 and it was fantastic. It's a case of, will some of these games hold the test of time? Zelda and Ocarina of Time, I don't know how many of you guys have played that game, but you know, it's, you know, people often say, oh, it's a masterpiece, and that'll always hold a 10 out of 10 game. But as I say, no game should score a zero other than Gears. But I say that people, I think rather than whether you score a game a 9 or a 9.5 or a 10, it's really irrelevant. I think Luke was saying something like, you know, unless it's a less than a 7, and I've played 7 out of 10 games, and I'm wondering to myself, why is this a 7? And why do I feel like, you know, I'm sort of set apart from the critics' reviews or reviewer reviews or whatever you want to call public reviews? And my biggest gripe is no game deserves a zero. And as soon as you see that, right, it's like it's pretty ridiculous in my opinion.
The ET game from the 1980s.
Yeah. I think like if a game is fundamentally broken, if it just does not work, then it deserves a zero. That's the only time.
Yeah.
That a game
you can't even play it when you can't.
Yeah,
it's
almost impossible.
You
to
boot
play.
In and you crash.
Yeah, or it's just, you know, it's running at 4 frames a second or whatever. Then by all means, give it a zero. Yeah. But
I totally agree with you, Luke. You know, because the problem is that when I see some of the youngsters, and I'm not saying all of them, but technology has led supposed to aid us, right, in now in this present day, right, but it's led to so much compulsion, the desire to being first, and really just poor habits in people in general, right, with leading to just so many low rent opinions. When I read like contrasting reviews, even from you know, critics, right, for certain games, and it's like sometimes I'm reading stuff and it's like, is this guy writing something, or is I'm just reading his like mental diarrhea on paper, basically? And it's
I try my best, VJ. Come on.
No. I said writing. You do videos.
I write as well.
I don't read your written work.
There we go. See?
I just watch the videos. Yeah. Help me to fall asleep. I think someone said it was completely subjective, and I agree with that.
It's true. The problem is, though, as well, is for some reason people think a seven out of ten is a bad game. In a lot of games, it's like, I believe that I know that you like the game Spider-Man, VJ. Now, didn't that win a load of critically acclaimed, and didn't that get like a 7 or 8 out of 10? That was a top tier game.
My affinity with Spider-Man is different. You have to understand is that, you know, when I was a kid, you used to be able to buy British comics, Marvel comics. I don't know if anyone did, but they're always like third taller and a third wider than the American comics, and they're always black and white.
Oh,
and,
interesting.
And what I used to go to walk to school during the week, not eat lunch, take all my pocket money and go up to central London, which was about an hour away, right, to Virgin Megastore or Comic Showcase. And back then, Forbidden Planet, we were in a back alley called Denmark Street. Like on the it was on the lip of Soho. And I used to go in there and pick up all my comics and buy spare plastic bags, pay the import price for these comic books, which were like 50 pence. They went up to 70, then they eventually got up to a pound. And, you know, I used to pick up Amazing Spider-Man, and then came Spectacular Spider-Man as well. And then they released the Web of Spider-Man. And I used to collect all three, along with all the other Marvel comics and so on and so forth. So, and I was really disappointed with all the Activision Spider-Man games, right? And the one time I really got excited about Spider-Man when he appeared in Super Shinobi as a boss. That I think it was Spider-Man that metamorphosized into Batman. It might have been Batman metamorphosizing into Spider-Man, but you can look it up on YouTube. And so when I actually got a hold of Insomniac's game, it was far, far superior and better than anything that I thought that might be out there. And it was actually a really, really good game, and had, you know, characters like Dr. Octopus and all that. Sorry if there's any spoilers in it for everybody, but Doc Ock and all that sort of stuff in it. And so for me, it kind of already had like a built-up perception. So regardless of what the score was, I was going to kind of enjoy it anyway. But it ended up being a brilliant game anyway. And I know there were some quarters where it did receive some criticism, but for what they produced in Insomniac in the period of time as well, in the development time frame they did, I think they did a fantastic job. But I don't know anyone else who's played it who wasn't collecting comics back in the 80s and 90s, so maybe they can have a say.
But yeah, I played it. Brilliant. It was a brilliant game. It scored really highly, actually. I think I don't know what the Metacritic is, but if I remember, it was 87, 88 on average, so it's so very good. I think in terms of the people thinking that 7's a bad score, that kind of goes back to the point I made earlier, which is that a lot of, well, probably the vast majority of reviewers don't use a full scale. So, you know, if you're, you know, the lowest score they will ever give is a 5, let's say, and that then becomes your baseline. So a 7 within that kind of understanding is you know, seen as a low score, and I think people have been somewhat conditioned by that as well. You know, I remember when Days Gone came out, right, and I think it, you know, it got 6s and 7s. It was kind of 72 average, and I, you know, people were, you know, really, really mocking it because it was seen as a low score. Clearly, that's, you know, on any normal scale, that's not a low score. But in the context of how games are reviewed nowadays, it kind of is, you know, it's kind of a lower score. So it's just kind of been, the whole scale has been subverted over the last maybe 5 to 10 years. It's kind of increasing, the baseline has increasingly crept up in these reviews. And I don't think that's because games have suddenly en masse, you know, got better. I mean, certainly they have in a lot of respects, but it's more just that the, I don't know, maybe standards have changed and, you know, perception has changed of scores, etc. So it's interesting, but also frustrating, I think.
I think definitely. I just think people have been programmed or reformatted, right, to follow numbers, right, perhaps more than the actual physical content of the product itself. Because I don't know how you feel about Days Gone, but I bought it and I plugged it in and I thought it was an amazing game. I thought it was incredible.
Yeah, I loved it. Yeah.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. And I think it goes back to Shizno Elite's point, right, which is that the best way, I think, to review games now, and certainly a lot of sites have changed their reviews to be more like this, but you also find it a lot with YouTubers like ACG and SkillUp, is that they just give a recommendation or they don't, you know, they say, you know, SkillUp, for example, who I think is a really great reviewer, you know, doesn't give a score because he realizes that it's just, it's a bit, it's so arbitrary just to pluck a number out and say, well, it's that, you know. He says that either he can't recommend the game or he really can't recommend the game or he can really highly recommend the game. And even other reviewers, I mean, I remember Jim Sterling as well, actually used to give in his reviews or in their reviews, you know, numerical value scores. But they then changed that because they got such hate from people for giving Breath of the Wild a 7 when it came out. You know, people were going absolutely ballistic, and so Jim Sterling just completely dropped scores from the reviews. So, yeah, I think, as you say, Vijay, people have been kind of, I don't know, there's this weird approach to scores. Yeah.
But I think you touch on something really important there, mob mentality, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And mob mentality will just lynch anybody that doesn't agree or has something to say that stands out from common belief. And belief is a really dangerous thing, right? Because when you believe something is good, or you believe that something deserves a 10 out of 10, belief is basically, let's be honest, you don't know, right? And people are too afraid to say they don't know. And effectively, let's be honest, you're just lying to yourself. You're just bullshitting yourself, right? And that's what I believe means, right? I'm not a lawyer, but maybe you can give a better definition than I can. I got kicked out of school when I was 15. So to say I don't know or I'm not sure, and not leaving that option open for, say, you know, like Paul was saying, you know, in terms of, you know, he has different tastes in games from other people, but that shouldn't stop you from enjoying it, right? So if someone does rate a specific game 7 out of 10 because they've got to review it, but that particular type of game doesn't resonate with them, then they're allowed to do that. So it gets, sometimes I do question, I don't know what game it was. It was a long time ago, but since then I stopped reading reviews. I try to identify, even Edge magazine, right? Because I don't do all the reviews internally, right? Is that if they've got an RPG game, but this specific reviewer only likes first-person shooters or beat-em-ups, how do they allocate the games during a busy season for somebody who understands a specific genre of gaming, or that might, you know, enjoy that specific game genre?
Mm. Oh, that reminds me of the guy that... That reminds me of the guy. I have to find the video for you from IGN. And he reviewed Crackdown 3. And he looked so bored. It was unreal. He wasn't really paying attention to what he was doing. It's one of the most awfulest reviews I've seen. It was like he was being forced to do the review. No one else wanted to do it.
Yeah. Well, it's like it's the same in other things too, like in movies. Like Roger Ebert was known for not liking horror movies at all. So anytime he had to review a horror movie, you knew he was gonna give it a thumbs down.
He
went in with a predetermined, I'm gonna hate this movie. You know, so, you know, why would you review something if you know you're going in that you're probably not going to like it?
You get paid.
Yeah.
But it's disingenuous. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm not good at platformers. I don't care for platformers because I can't play them. So why would I review a platformer? You know, knowing that I can't play the damn game going in, you know?
Indie Gamer, welcome. Hope you're doing well, mate.
Is it one done?
Yeah, I think so.
Right, okay. I've been chomping at the bits, biting my lip throughout the whole of this. I'll give everyone's review. I'll give everyone's view here a 6 out of 10. I'm going to feed into a lot of people's conversations here. So apologies. Anyway, someone who kind of has been reviewing for quite a while, and who's old enough to remember the original scores. An original way of doing things back then. This is kind of coming back into Luke's thing. The old original scoring system was very much pixelated into, as you said, zero was at the time was never ever seen as something that you could ever be used against any game. In fact, I think if I remember correctly, there was only one time it was ever used around the 1990s, and it was because the game wasn't a game. It turned out to be an advert, touted as a game. And they actually said, this is not a game. This is an advert. It gets a zero. 10, on the other hand, I do remember historically, 10s were often utilized for game of the century or game of those elements. So what they would do is they'd go back to the very high scoring ones and then replay it again. And over time, see if that standard still held up. If it did, it then got bumped up to a 10 because it was deemed to not only be great at the time it was done, but also it held up further down the line. Something which really can't really be used in today's scale. But as you quite rightly said, back then, sevens and eights were very, very high. They were classified as your top tier games. Nines were almost, it was almost barely ever utilized. And tens, again, as I said, was often seen as a game of a generation, game of a century that was looked at historically and then bumped up into that almost. And they were the pinnacle rarest points of that element. So really, it was around the 1990s and 2000s. That was the score. Your fives, as it would have been, would be, it's all right. It's nothing bad. It's nothing wrong. It's nothing too bad. Your threes were like, it's not really that good. It has some good points, but it's not really good. And unfortunately, as time went on, as magazine distribution reduced, and as the collation of scoring systems came in, put into databases, that's when we started to see what I would classify as societal pressure on game scores. I personally don't believe in game scores. Now, it's an outdated kind of system. I don't use it myself when I review games. It's an outdated system, as you said. It's opinion, very much opinions. But back then, they were there. Again, it was a double thing. It was there to not only inform the person who's buying the game, but as rightly said, we spoke on it earlier, it was there to inform the publisher. And in a way, it was there to see whether or not the developer was worth money in moving and getting funds for their next project. So it was almost a two-tier system, one for the consumer and one for the publisher. That, as I said, with databases came in, societal pressure then started being applied to that scoring system. And that's how we kind of now have got to where we are, where they're kind of meaningless because societal pressure has put so much on it, and it's so easily manipulated, it is kind of a superfluous element. And as you said now from previously, is if it's not an eight or a nine, it's almost that is your average score rather than your rarity. I think today it's going to be a system that is really, I see it's going to be dead within the next 10 years. Numerical score is going to be dead. I think as Skill Up or as AVG does, it's going to be much more of a recommendation based scoring system, which will move force forward into the next element. It's also a personal opinion, but historically, that's why I thought I'd kind of dive in there. That's where it was originally based. It was kind of utilized as a two-tier system to not only inform the consumer, but inform the publishers where funds were coming from. Please feel free to tell me off. Anyone disagree
now
with what I've
just
said?
Now we're just in general. Now we're just in general. Oh,
yeah. You can say now we're in general. it's a weird one. I think, as you said, societal pressure is
about telling you off.
Oh, well, yeah, you can tell me. You know, Paul, you can always tell me off. I think societal pressure is stupid. You can see now.
There you go. There's a message from Indy there.
Yes, sir.
Matthew met Indy there. You see it?
Societal pressure, that's deep. Yeah, well, it is. You think about it back in the days, the best, what's the worst societal pressure you could get from your fanboys back from your systems? What would they do? They'd have to write a letter to the magazine editor that could take you about 3 to 4 weeks to get there if it ever got read. And what you do, you just send a nasty letter, and most of the time that would probably get binned anyway. It was very hard to influence scores back in the old days. Now, it's as simply as clicking on a social media site, and you can inform directly the person who's made the game, or directly inform who's critiqued the game, what you think. You get enough of people of that, it's gonna hit back, isn't it? So,
well, and because I think it's social media. you know, one guy in your circle says, oh, I hate this game, this game is stupid. So even though you've never played this game, you're going to forward his tweet and say, you know what, this game is stupid, this is a waste of time. Even though you personally have never played the game, you're basing your opinion on what he says. Yep. And so exactly, and that's stacks up.
Yeah. I said numerical system doesn't make sense in today's society. It just doesn't. Not unless we go back to the original basis of that numerical system, where society agrees that 7 is actually really, really good. A 9 is almost a shining beacon of light that's very hard to touch in any format. And a 3 is pretty crap. And a 5, yeah, it's all right either way. Until we, if the only way that's will ever, you know, that's the only way I can see, you know, numerical system coming back. And I don't think that will ever happen these days because, you know, pressure, society, fanboyism. It's all moved things at such a degree that it's pointless. It's pointless now. It is the better systems now is a much more open dialogue, honest opinion about the game, whilst acknowledging maybe its critiques, but also providing some solutions. I see, another thing I keep seeing with a lot of reviewers is they love to critique, but they never provide any solutions. Oh, this control system's clunky. Okay, and well, you could maybe you adjust please the sensitivity of the mouse stick? Could you put some add in some extra options? If you're not going to provide, you know, this is what I try to. If I do something, is I try to provide a critique. I try and automatically add in a solution in some format because it's very easy to critique anything. But to provide solutions a lot harder. And I think that then benefits not only the people playing, the people you're speaking to, but also the developer. Because, you know, we've got games now that can be patched.
See, are you saying that I don't think numbers will go away removable, because I think it's the dynamics of the industry have changed completely. That's obvious, right, given the where technology is and given the amount of budget that games have these days, right? There's far too much to lose, right? And the thing is, if you want to communicate, let's take the movie industry, right? When you walk past, and this may not be, you know, relevant, but let's just take you're in the underground, right? When you go to you see all these movie posters up, whether they're for the latest, you know, big budget movie from Marvel or whether it's an independent game, right? Everybody's been programmed to look at the number of stars that movie's got, right? And it's always, a 4-star system now. So I think the communication system, I think there's two things there. There's the communication system from because let's be honest, the reviews on Twitter or on Metacritic is still a very small fraction of the overall public that goes and buys a game. But a game sells 10 million. What's the biggest number of reviews you'll find on Steam or on Metacritic? 30,000, 50,000, 100,000?
Yep.
It's a very small percentage. But for the light user out there, the mass market, they are programmed to consume numbers, right? And that's why I think that depending on publishers, they will be the drivers as to whether or not numbers will be done away with, because I still think that, well, I don't know to what degree, but I still feel that word of mouth, speaking to you.
Yeah, I semi-agree. I think the thing, what you're saying here is, and movies is a brilliant analogy to utilize, is we say, as you said, you see the 4 stars. I've seen posters now.
Do I get a 10 out of 10 for that?
You do, yeah. If anything now, I would say it's that they've become, posters are superfluous now. They're white noise. How many people actually take notice of the 4 stars plastered everywhere? Do you know what I would say is more actually thing? I would say YouTube views.
I agree with you, they are
the drivers now versus the numerical system.
I would say I agree with you, but I would say that there's more than just YouTube, because the underground, right? I think that there's many ways to market a product, and the reason why they still market a product, because yes, people may go to YouTube and watch a trailer and they get 30 million views and people may or may not decide to get it, but that supplementary subliminal marketing, right, with numbers, and you may not actually see the poster, but you will remember, even if you don't take it in completely, that subliminal way of marketing outdoors still has how can I put it, still has an influence.
Right, has an effect. Yeah, it has an effect.
I think it does. So I know what you're saying, VJ. You know, from the days when we used to run to the shops and buy CMVG and sort of skip all the stuff at the front and then go to the back of the magazine where they used to have a meme machine section. I don't know if Luke or Stubbsan are old enough to remember those. And, you know, and they used to have a section on the back saying gaming from the, I don't know, from the land of the rising sun or something, right? And look at these 128, look at these sprites that are as tall as a screen and on all that sort of stuff. And they've got 16 colors per character. But anyway, my point being is that I know that the ways and means and methods of marketing has changed, right? And it's a lot more consumable, right? Even with a 5-second ad, you know, while you're playing a video game or consuming something on YouTube. But I still think that for a large portion of the demographic, and especially across different parts of the world where technology isn't as prevalent, that the ways and means of marketing are still covered, whether it's paper on YouTube or, you know, as I say, or posters on an underground. And I don't agree it will disappear.
But I think at the moment,
the message, yeah.
Yeah, I think I don't think it'll disappear entirely, but I think it's on its way out. And I'm going to go with the more developed countries here as a guide to where we're potentially moving forward in the future. You know, it's the advertisement space these days is in every aspect you look at. It's not really, you know, what's the one thing that you spend 99% of your time on? It's ironically, we walk around like zombies now, it's attached to our phone. It's our phone. That is the advertisement space that everybody wants to get into. Your billboards and that, and this is one of the things, at least, which I've noticed when I'm going to London, is that there's a lot of empty billboards now. There is advertisement, but there is seems to be much more advertisement directly targeted to the user through the use of their phone, their interaction maybe with a different person, than it is now the traditional way. For the undeveloped countries, 100%, that is their premier utilization for advertisement. But I would say it's going to be a couple of generations where paper advertisement or that sort of marketing is going to be phased out. And again, as you rightly said, it's going to be word of mouth. And I generally think it's going to be videos or clicks will be the former. Oh, this seems to have got, you know, 60,000 likes, a thumbs up. Clearly, it must be good.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean it will be, but, you know, I think that's where it's going to be pushing towards. I think, you know, we are, maybe I'm, you know, we're, I would say, a couple of generations out, and I think the old traditional ways of advertising is going to be pushed. Your phone is going to be your gateway advert into your life, and I think everything else is just going to be kind of white noise. And I mean, you can see that with the way people are now, where they're like zombies looking at their phone.
I agree, getting hit by a car.
Yeah, I understand.
It's supplemental support to the main. Main course or the main event. I get that.
That's it for me.
But listen, Luke, we want a unique perspective because you live in Jersey and I have no idea, like, in what century you guys are in over there. You might be about...
I do have power, you know.
It's not dial-a-phone on the wall, you know. It's still got cords. It's still got cords there.
I'm going to say, we know Stubbs is in the early 17th century over there, but, you know.
Yeah, yeah, we are. We're our bloody internet, definitely. Yeah.
It's internet.
Yeah.
Luke, go on. We cut you off there for a second.
Did you? No, I wasn't, wasn't going to say anything other than to lambast VJ.
Oh no! I thought you were saying something beginning with B and ending in B.
But no, there's been a mix of opinions. Indie Game has got one here, a comment. People get all strange when it comes to reviews. It's so weird. We hear opinions from peers every day on here. Podcast and they're fine with it, but review score, oh no, LOL. He's right. Shizno Elite says, would you just like games to be rated for what they are and not what people expected? And now that's a big problem with reviews. I'm not saying for the indie, more indie games, but for a lot of these big games, the people, I don't know why gamers raise their expectations, even though the developers haven't said this is going to blow your effing mind. It's going to be like playing Halo back when you were a teenager or a kid. Because that's what people are expecting from Halo. If people don't know, they're expected to read. I've seen tweets of people who are expected to relive their youth through Halo. It's going to be like it was back in the day, man. You know what I mean? But yeah, but people do rate. Shizno's got a good point. People do raise their expectations by themselves. I don't know why they do.
I think that's where
we see it every day. We see it every day, and then they come back and they say, "Well, I wanted this and I wanted that, and they didn't do this, so that's not good."
They didn't promise it.
Unless you were sitting in on some of the meetings, then shut up.
Yeah, I think generally that will tell you whether or not the person, if you're a good reviewer, keeping your own bias in check, keeping your own expectations in check. And let's face it, it's a hard thing to do, you know, in any element of gaming. It is a hard thing to do, to try and, you know, make sure you are the most unbiased reviewer out there. You know, as you said, you know, you could be an absolute fan of FPS but absolutely hate walking sims, and so when you do get a walking sim, you know, you think, oh, you have to be, you, this is the hard thing in reviewing in general, I think, is trying to be as unbiased as critical and look at it from almost a reviewing perspective outside of your own being, if that makes sense. You know, you kind of try and not let any of your own biases influence anything you do. And it's I say that's almost impossible, no matter how hard you try. But that's why I think, you know, these scores of an opinion pieces are a much better option, because you can say, look, you know, I'm not ideally a fan. And if you are going to do that, this is why I think you should always, you know, always be honest when you are reviewing. It's like, Jerry, not a fan of first-person shooters, but I quite like this one. Or, you know, if you are being put into that position, be honest, you know, and just say, look, this is a reviewer. I don't like first-person shooters, but I'm reviewing this game. At least then the person at the other end can take on board that and take on board your comments in a much more informed way. I think it's when people say where it is perceived, you know, their bias isn't showing, when clearly, as you said, yeah, Paul, they are fundamentally biased, and you can see it in the way it's written, you can see it in the way it's portrayed. Well, and it's almost like they don't care.
The phrases I watch for are things like, well, they should have done this and they didn't. Okay, now you're putting your bias into what you think they should have done. You know,
well, the best one is, I didn't like it.
Yeah.
And leave it as a dot. That's it. That's the end of the stop. I didn't like it.
Sorry.
Why didn't you like it?
I think I might have misunderstood the question, because I wasn't really answering the question initially from the point of view that, you know, should games get XYZ review? It's all subjective. But I think if I was going to say to a friend of mine, look, you know, he was saying, oh, you know, I'm going to buy this game, what do you think? And it was XYZ game. And I would have said, look, you know, at that time when I played it, for me, it was a 10 out of 10. That's how I would communicate it, right? So I sometimes ask, look, I even asked the indie gamer, right, when he first mentioned Hollow Knight, I said, look, I'm not really keen on the graphic style, but, you know, what do you think? And he said, look, it's one of the best games I've ever played. And so when I played Hollow Knight, and it was a 10 out of 10 experience for me. And that's how I would communicate it, say to Paul or to you or whatever, right? But reading reviews, I stopped reading them a long, long time ago, because they just, it's all completely subjective, right? At the end of the day, right? Paul and you are right, you know, people may criticize the game, but they don't know why they're doing it. And a lot of the time I get this feeling that sometimes the reviewers, especially when it's a busy time of year, right, when there's lots and lots of games out, and everyone's trying to, you know, if someone's reviewing Assassin's Creed or whatever, Valhalla, you know, that's about the only game that could possibly get done, right, in about a month. So it's like, there's so many of them, and you're going to find where publications, whether they're online or whatever, YouTube, etc., you know, games are going to get passed around, which are not necessarily the right fit for the person who's playing it, and they may not necessarily be interested, right?
Well, this is where I think the professionalism comes in, and this is a kind of a bugbear for me in terms of game reviews and games journalism, is that, at least in my opinion, I think that's professionalism has kind of slacked off, and this is due to games becoming more and more prominent, more and more games are coming out at a rate of knots, and so that professionalism is slightly, it's the lacking, I'm trying to think of the best terminology of saying this, is that it seems to be, you know what, I'll just get something out, that'd be good enough, rather than going in with the full, you know, putting in your full professionality into this and saying, even if you don't like it, even if you have a bias and being honest, you know, I think that has kind of fed its way in, creeped its way into the gaming elements. And unfortunately, it's been allowed to fester, and it's been accepted by a lot of gaming sites and gaming things. That's like, well, he didn't play 95%. He actually played 25% of it. That's good enough. He's put in a clicky head bait. That'd be fine. Once you allow those bad standards in, it's hard to get away from it. It is literally like a virus. If you just need one or two people to allow those bad standards in, it will then be seen by other outlets as, well, if they get away with it, why can't I? And before you know it, that becomes the norm. Back in the heyday, I would say, of gaming reviewers, and I think it is also because, again, back in the gaming reviewers' days, early around the 1990s, 2000s, they were fighting to be seen as professional. It was their professionality was a lot higher and a lot, because they wanted to be seen. You know, they were looked down upon by generally other professional industries. Gaming reviewers and gaming sites were looked down upon as just some sort of fad. Game journalism in itself was just looked and sneered upon. I remember hearing about it. It's like, it'll never last. What's that doing here? You know. So back then, they were really pushing hard to try and showcase off and be as professional as possible. And unfortunately, as you said, as time's come in, it's kind of literally, you know, bad elements have kind of been allowed in it, and it's getting worse and worse and worse. And in a way, it kind of needs that, almost like, nope, we've got to go back to the old professional standards, you know, where we're honest, we appreciate, you know, we show off, we confirm our biases when they're there.
I think you're right, and I think what Paul was saying earlier in terms of like the vocabulary that people use to complain, and then they don't say why. I think what you're saying is, besides professionalism, I don't know how much these guys get paid. I don't know how much time they get given, but when I read certain sort of language being structured together, and I'm no English literature professional, but it's like you can sense that, where's the pride and where's the integrity in this review for me to take it on face value, regardless of the fact if I disagree with it or not? And that's what put me off of reading a lot of reviews. So I just ask other people, and I can't remember I just finished a game, what was it, Narita Boy, and I couldn't find really.
No, it's Gina, didn't he? Gina mentioned that.
I don't know who recommended it to me, but it may not have been. I may have just heard it and played it. And also, what was it? The Artful Escape. I'm just playing at the moment. But the Narita Boy, I have to say, was absolutely an amazing game, and I love the ending, and I can't wait for the sequel. And there's a parody. Oh, I don't really want to spoil it for anyone in case anyone's going to play it. But I thought it was
I wouldn't do it, because it does need. It does, yeah.
Absolutely brilliant. It might have been you, actually. You might have mentioned it on the show.
No, I think it was the Jinner. The Jinner mentioned it. He was previously playing through it. I think it's one of his top games, which kind of, I think it helped him push him into indies, if I remember correctly.
Has anyone else played it on the panel?
No, I've not played that one yet.
That's quite surprising. Haven't. You don't play anything. Go on. Who else? I'm just kidding. Stop, Sam. Please don't throw me off the show. It's the only time I get to speak to other human beings.
Ha 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 ha. start again now. He's had the half, he's off now. Oh,
he's trying to find the eject VJ button. He's not sure.
Or blow up VJ. Luke, have you played it at all?
I played it a bit, but I kind of dropped it. Not, funnily enough, not because I didn't enjoy it, because I did. It's just, you know, kind of one of those games that goes by the wayside.
Okay, whatever. Anyone else?
Oh, the joys. Stubbs, you've gone quiet again.
I missed all of that. My computer, because I've done that as a joke.
We were just basically saying how lovely you were. How much we respect you, how much we love you.
I'll go back and listen to that. I will.
Okay.
It's been a... I didn't really expect that to be such a big topic, but, you know, it's been a really interesting one from all different perspectives. It's been good to go from all different views. We've gone quite... what's it called? Quite in depth into this subject. So I knew it would be popular. But thanks for your opinions and coming on. It's been a good topic and a good show. So Luke Steel, thank you for joining us, especially as you're on holiday as well. I appreciate that. Thanks for your time.
No, you're very welcome. Yeah, really enjoyed it. And sorry about
the cock up at the start.
That's okay. It's all right. It does happen. It does happen. Yeah. That's all right.
Do you want to tell people where they can find you?
Yeah, sure. So I'm on Twitter at LukeSteel90, and as you very helpfully said at the start of the show, I'm on Green Pass Gaming, which is on usually on every Sunday at 8 PM UK time, 3 PM Eastern.
This is a very good show. If you haven't tried it out, people,
very good show.
Go and try it out. It's a very, very good show. It is. I've linked the YouTube channel in the description for Green Pass Gaming as well. Awesome. I have. So thanks for coming on, Luke. I'll have to get you on again at some point, most definitely.
Yeah, absolutely.
We will in the future. And Removable Sanity, thanks for coming on.
Again, thank you for having me on and even remotely listen to me ramble on and, you know, bring back the old days.
you took the reviewing subject to a whole other level. You did. That was really, really good. That was very deep. Subject.
I apologise to all. I apologise if I've made you all fall asleep and that you've lost views just because of me. It is one of the things. It's a passion of mine. I enjoy it, and as I say, you know, I do like to criticise, but at the same time, I criticise because I want not only gaming journalists but gaming reviewers to be kept going for as long as there's games, you know. And so that's why I'm a little bit passionate about it in that regards, you know. But nice. Apologies to all.
I need to apologise. It was good conversation. It was, as always. Do you want to tell people where they can find you?
Oh yes, I keep forgetting about that. My brain's going, baby brain. Yes, you can find me on Minds, YouTube, Twitter, and Xbox under the name Removable Sanity.
Thanks for coming on again, Removal, and Cerebral Paul. Thanks for coming on, and you probably have to abbreviate where to find you because.
Well, let's see. In about 5 minutes after I get off here, you can find me on. I'm not kidding. You can find me
ex-hamster.
On Fun Speculation. I will be joining them right after this show.
And well, they've got a new show.
We're talking about Star Wars tonight. So, I.
Oh, ooh, is it a fun pop?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And then,
cool.
And then tomorrow, you can find me on the 4GQ TV. After that, just go to Twitter, find me there, and you can see where I'm at. CerebralPaul1 on Twitter, the best way to find me. And CerebralPaul921 on Xbox if you want to follow me there.
Thanks for coming on, Paul. It's always good to hear your opinions on. It definitely is. And VJ.
It's always good to share my opinion. Somebody's got to listen to me because I don't. So.
I do.
No, it's always good to have you on. It's a good one. It is. And VJ, thanks for coming on, sir.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate it. It feels a little strange because your icon on your screen's blank, so I'm not sure what you're up to there.
Really? Is that right? Is it been like that the whole show?
I'm not sure for the entire show, but it's not the only place your icon's missing. It's been missing on WhatsApp as well. But it was really good to have Luke on. I haven't chatted with Luke for a long, long time. It was really great to have him on. On the show, so I'd love to have him back on again if that's possible. I'll raise my hand.
He's been a very good, very good guest. Yeah. And the logo as to what you're on about on WhatsApp is because I got added to a parents group on school, and a picture of Stubbsan looks very weird, so I had to change my picture. That's why.
Don't scare.
Didn't want to
off.
Go to school. What does Stubbs mean at school? So,
oh,
you
know, I don't know.
That's
why
I changed the picture and the name on it.
That's cool.
That's why.
I didn't go to private school like Luke.
Raised on a council estate, VJ.
Yep.
No private schools.
The closest I got to Eton, where Luke went, is when I had to deliver milk for the kids, you know, so they could grow up healthy and strong and move to Jersey. We're all the elitists too.
Kids from Sheffield don't go to Eton. They don't go there.
Sheffield still. Yeah. And I just want to say, I know not everyone might remember, but everybody know that John Chalice Boycie passed away a couple of days ago.
He did. Yeah, it's a shame that is, really yeah. is. That's yeah. Legend.
They're all knocking off one by one. So
they are. Shame.
I'm actually watching through all the Only Fools and Horses shows. The download, I get them from a special place and I download them because obviously the ones that they show on the BBC and UK Gold now, and even the DVDs you buy, they've been edited, you see. Words,
heavily edited.
Edited for political correctness, and so I can't watch those. And when I do watch them,
we'll have to talk about this.
Many of them. Yeah.
There were some phrases that would not be acceptable. And in today's society.
And I can't watch them without those phrases.
It won't be the same, would it?
No, it's not.
You're right there.
It's not. And brilliant to have Luke. Nice to have Removable on for 2 or 3 weeks in a row. It's a miracle. And Paul, always, as always, it's a pleasure. And I'm telling you, this guy, last week he was Mel Gibson. This week, I don't know, he's like from the Unforgotten movie with Clint Eastwood. And next week, I have no idea. Maybe he's going to turn up as, Robert De Niro. Who's the other guy in Death Wish? Charles Bronson. Oh, yeah. Next week he's going to turn up as Charles Bronson. So thanks for having me on, Stubbs.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. Are you on Mr. Boom show tomorrow as well?
Yeah, or? I am, and I'm. I just want to say, if I know that maybe it doesn't interest a lot of people, but Lost Judgment's out this week, and I don't care what the review score is, I'll be buying it.
Yeah, that's going to be a resounding 5 out of 10. Yeah. Superb.
10 out of 10 in my books. Biased opinion.
Anyway, thanks for joining us everyone, and I've just seen in the chat everyone say happy birthday to the Indie Gamer. Happy birthday Indie Gamer.
Happy 25th.
Squared.
And we will see you next week. Thanks for coming on, and thanks chat for tuning in. Sorry about the tech issues. Hopefully this won't happen next week. And I'll see you all soon. Thanks. Well, see ya.
Timmy just showed up for the end, so you need to say it.
Bye.
It's Timmy. No, that's terrible. It's Timmy. That's better.
That's better. There you go.
See you next week, guys and girls.
See everybody later.